Right, welcome back to the Film Frequency podcast. We're back with our first film deep dive of season four. And today we're going to be talking about David Robert Mitchell's 2014 horror, It Follows. So the film stars Micah Monroe. And the description on IMDb says that it's a young woman who's followed by an unknown supernatural force after a sexual encounter. So that's quite a crisp and tight, brief synopsis, I have to say. And I kind of encapsulates the whole film for sure. And we're joined today with myself and Mark and Alex, and we're all in the same room for once, which is great. And we're all going to be recording this together today. So me and Mark actually just re-watched the film there about an hour ago, and Alex, you watched it for the third time a couple of months ago, didn't you?
Yeah, that's correct.
That's not too bad. Yeah, I think this is only the second time I've seen it, and Mark, is the second time you've seen it?
Yeah, second time.
So Mark, what did you think? Just straight off the bat, your kind of second viewing, because I know I rated this very high on IMDb, and I know Alex is a huge fan of this movie as well. What about yourself, Mark?
I saw this in cinemas when it first came out in 2014, and it was a real refreshing type of horror film with a really interesting concept that we'd never seen before. I think when I started watching it, I can't remember what horror films had come out preceding it, but it just felt like everything was so bland and repetitive, with jump scares, with a lot of the horror films that were coming out beforehand. So to see this completely new, interesting concept and, you know, done well as well, really kind of took me by surprise. And I would say it's one of the best horror films of the 2010s. I give this, you know, when I rate horror films, I kind of rate them on a different scale to other films. I don't know, I just feel like the genre is so different from a lot of other genres. Same thing with comedies. I feel like that's also another type of genre that I would have its own scale. But I rated this an 8 out of 10 on the horror scale from films that I've seen in that genre. And rewatching it, I would still agree. I think it's probably an 8 out of 10 for me. So yeah, and it has a good rewatchability factor. I still really enjoyed it, and there were still lots of bits and pieces of the film I forgot about.
Yeah, it's definitely very tense. It's a very tense film. And we were talking as we were watching it about the cinematography really plays well into that. Uses a lot of wide lenses for these kind of lingering shots. And I know you mentioned a lot of zooms as well, a lot of zooming in, and, you know, the camera just kind of holds a lot of the time on the frame. But yeah, Alex, what did you think, even your third time watching it? Did you think it has the same kind of, it holds up every time after time?
Yeah, I think I agree with Mark in that watching it again, it's every bit as good as it was the first time. There's a great rewatch factor to it. And I think whenever you said it was tense, it is tense, but it's also enjoyably so. It's quite pacey as well. I know a lot of films nowadays have been tending to stretch into the 2 hours, and this just clips over 90 minutes, am I correct?
Yeah.
Yeah. It's original. It's something that you don't get to see often with horror films. A lot of it's just retreads on old films or old styles. I think if you've seen Halloween, you've probably seen about 100 other horror films in that style.
True. So,
yeah, and this just feels something completely different. You're probably not going to see something exactly like this for a long time, and that's not going to be because they're trying to recreate it. You know.
On the note of Halloween kind of ripoffs, I do think there are certainly nods to Halloween in this film that we were talking about, Corey. Just to do with the shots that are being used, the kind of panning forward shots, the zoom ins and the wide shots, and then of course the suburban like area that a lot of the film is based around. You know, it definitely felt like callbacks to, and on top of the fact that the villain in this piece is a slow moving villain that kind of, you know, constantly is trying to, you know, track down and kind of follow someone, you know, a bit like Michael Myers. What did you think about, you know, its comparisons to Halloween? Did you spot them as well?
Yeah, definitely. We picked up on it almost adds to that. It's the same thing that really happened. Probably that begins with the old, like, zombie movies. The fact that the zombies are only walked a certain speed and then, but they're always coming for you type of thing. Probably, you know, it bases off that back with George A. Romero's Night of the Living Dead films. And I think David Robert Mitchell had said that Romero was a big influence for him on this movie. And that works, you know, I think really well in horror films, you know, slow moving predators that are coming to get you is great, and it just has that added value of it means they can't be caught, but they always are caught is the thing in horror films. It's like they always say to, like, everyone says, oh, but why does people not just run away from Michael Myers? But it's a movie, you know, that doesn't work that way.
I mean, horror is all about dread. I mean, if you wanted something moving quick at you, you'd want a thriller, you know. It's the difference. You want something that's slowly building up to you, and rather than just something that's going to bolt.
Yeah, no, definitely. So yeah, about the film's concept, I think Mitchell said that this is an idea that came to him in a dream. So he had this recurring dream of this, like, predator just constantly walking slowly towards him, and obviously that's kind of what we get with the movie. Yeah, so the film starts off with Jay, and I actually read that Jay was a nod to Jamie Lee Curtis, of course, the lead from Halloween films, with her being the kind of the scream queen of It Follows. And yeah, she's kind of started this relationship with this this guy, and then they have sex, and you quickly realize that everything isn't as it seems. And he kind of explains to her what's happened after they've had sex. He's passed on this this horror of this beast that's going to be, like, following her, his curse. Yeah, puts her in a chair and kind of, like, shows her the thing coming towards her. So this is what's going to happen, and then you're just gonna have to deal with all this in your movie, and I'm gonna go now. But it was really nice getting to know you. Yeah, so that was an interesting way to do the kind of exposition, I have to say, for the start of the film.
Yeah, just in one big bulk, like, as well. I mean, god, as much as I love it, you have Everything Everywhere All at Once, which has to bring new elements every 10-15 minutes. This is just, right, here's the rules. Mm-hmm. In 3 minutes, here you go. Yeah. I think that's just, it's so clean.
Yeah, because he explains that, you know, if you die, it'll come back to me, and things like that. And then obviously anyone who dies just continually gets the curse back the way. So we kind of get this kind of cat and mouse with her kind of getting chased by this beast. And yeah, continues for quite a while, and there's a scene, so she actually goes back to him, doesn't she, later on in the film, to kind of get a bit more information.
I think that also it wasn't very exposition heavy, even though it was exposition heavy, it served the plot, the fact that she had to be told about it, and therefore we were let into that world, and also we didn't see it coming as much. I would have liked to have watched this film having not seen any trailers for it, because then you would have really then fallen for it kind of as much as she did, to go, oh flip, this is not what I thought it was, you know. I thought I was in this relationship with this guy or this fling, and I like the concept of passing it from person to person, and the fact that you don't know who's going to take, you know, how, what form that this thing, this demon is going to take, like, and that opens up so many opportunities, a bit like Paranormal Activity, where, you know, you get panning shots happening. And there's small details which you have to look out for, of, you know, people that maybe wondering. You get the paranoia as much as she probably gets as well, because you're like, are they directly moving towards me, or is this just something? Is this just a normal person walking towards me? And you get that in the film where, you know, the characters catch on to say, if they're around other people, do you see this person? And if they don't, then they know it's the demon after them.
Yeah, that's a very brave film as well, because I think my favorite sort of jump scare, well, no, scare, you can't really call it a jump scare, but my favorite one of those scares was when they're sitting in the car talking in the school car park, and there's someone just in the far distance through the front windscreen just walking towards them really, really slowly, and they never comment upon it. So you're just watching it, and if you notice it, you notice it. If you don't, it's just a conversational scene. It does, it's fine. But whenever you notice it, you just get like a little jolt in your heart. You're like, oh, no.
Yeah, of dread.
Yeah.
Is that the scene where, because we watched it and it just cuts away? Is that the person who's like almost on the car bonnet? Like, it's very clear that it's someone moving towards the front, and Jay doesn't seem to see it. Yeah. And then all of a sudden we cut to, like, and I was like, what happened there? Did they, you know, did that escalate into a situation? Or
they just didn't notice, because it's just always there, always following.
Yeah. I did realize the character Jay in this, she does sit or place her back to a lot of exposed areas during the summer. You pointed out, Corey, when they're on the beach, and she literally sits facing the beach or facing the sea, which would be the last position you would want to place yourself if you know that someone's coming after you.
Yeah, so it's interesting. We talk about the way the film is kind of written and put together. There's so only Jay is the only one who can see this demon, and basically it's interesting that they didn't introduce, because there's not a lot of like parental characters in this movie, and there's not a lot of people. I would have expected there would be a lot of the film where people are just disregarding everything she's saying, you know, and saying, oh no, she's just having trauma with, you know, the fact that she was potentially sexually assaulted. And, you know, a lesser horror film would maybe have scenes in there where she's like talking to the police and she's talking to her parents and, you know, they're saying, oh no, nothing happened. As a guy. And they kind of, they throw all that out, and there's a little bit, and it's interesting because they're kind of teenagers, you know, there's an element where her friends believe her very quickly, and that's the kind of thing as at that age you might, you know, especially in a film like this, and you know, they start to believe her pretty quickly. And then we obviously get the scene at the beach that we just said, where the other characters actually encounter the demon and kind of get affected by it themselves. And I like that they didn't focus too much on, you know, the whole whether she's telling the truth or whether not. What do you think about that, Alex?
I think it just ties into one of the major themes of everything. It's obviously, it's a very bizarre coming-of-age film in its own way. It's these characters on the onset of adulthood exploring casual sex. In this world, sort of, the parents don't matter as much. It's not really a story about their relationship with the older generation. It's about them exploring themselves, other people, on this kind of periphery between being teenagers to being adults. And the fact that none of the parents are involved, they're always on the periphery, they're always maybe even the monster chasing them. Mm. I think that just, you know, speaks a lot to the how that isn't really a world that those generations tend to interact. I mean, if you told your parents you were being chased by a sex monster, I mean, you wouldn't really, would you? Yeah. It's not really something you talk about with them, so it's almost commenting on the fact that these conversations aren't being had between an older generation and a younger generation. That's something I think that comes back to it as well, is that there's the obvious parallel between the monster and sexually transmitted diseases, and there's something to say about the fact that the parents just aren't there, they aren't aware of this monster, they aren't informing children about this monster or younger people about this monster. It almost speaks to, like, you know, some old school traditions of really bad sex education for younger generations from those above them.
Yeah, I think that whole message, I can get the explanation that you're giving for the fact that there is no parental guidance in this film, really. But I think this is my issue with types of films where a lot of the illogical plot threads are generally down to metaphors that are being placed. I don't generally like that, because that's what brings me out of a film, is when I go, wait, what is going on? Why is the mum not here at all? There's been a smashed window, there's people screaming in the house, and there's no mention of this mum. But I think with this film, and there's other things that don't add up, which we can get into, with like very old antique gadgets and objects being used in the house, even though it's present day, and even weird lighting situations, like in the car with this guy near the start, where it's like very, very well lit, the car, like it's almost like spotlighted, even though there's no, you know, no light coming from nearby. But, you know, when it comes to horror, I can almost overlook those kind of things, because obviously they're there deliberately. And clearly the director and the, you know, cinematographer aren't there to try and make it very grounded in this film. It's quite clear to see that. Even the characters are very flat, and it almost seems very staged, like actual scenes. But I think it works in the style that's happening here, because it adds to the fear factor of the film. And, you know, primarily a horror film, I want to be scared. Like, that is the priority, more than grounded characters with character arcs. You know, that's not the primary reason that I go into a horror film, and therefore that's why I can overlook it. Now, if that was in a drama or in something that wasn't horror, that would be where I would be more picky, and it would bug me more if it wasn't in a horror genre. But I can allow it in this horror genre.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I don't think horror films are noted for having the most, like, characters with the most developed internal lives. I mean, most of them are just there to be vessels for you to experience this through. They're just like vessels, really. You're right about the other characters. I could not tell you a single thing about any of the other characters outside of Jay, and that's it should be like a really damning thing to say about a film, but it's fine. It's not necessary. They're just decoration essentially, but it's nice decoration anyway.
Yeah, I think it kind of works. And it also has that, to jump back to kind of the 70s horror vibes that the film gives. I think, you know, a lot of the dialogue felt like a 70s horror. And I think that, you know, even what the characters say other than Jay, and you're right, they're very, very flat characters. And, you know, there was a scene on the porch of one of their houses, and it just felt like those three people haven't said a word to themselves all night until that one character comes up and they have to make, you know, conversation.
Where they, do they not just look up and go, where's Jay? Or something is really off.
Yeah. But I think it kind of adds to the whole feel of the film. So I'm okay. I can overlook it.
So we were talking a wee bit there about the cinematography of the film. It's done by, is it a guy called Mike Giolakis?
Mike Giolakis. I like Mike Giolakis. He does very weird things on occasion.
Yeah, you were saying he did the he does a lot of M. Night Shyamalan.
Yes, movies. He's teamed up with Shyamalan. He's even got a cameo in Old. Giolakis, I think this is his high watermark. That's one of his earliest films. I think since then he's got a real talent for lighting. I found it really funny whenever you said, Mark, about the spotlighting on the car and why is that? I mean, it's because they thought it looked cool. And I don't even subscribe to that. I love the idea of, you know, motivated lighting. But for this, it's just so heavily stylized that it can get away with an awful lot. And as you said about the 70s stylings in it, there's like a lot of anachronisms within the film. There's just so many things that seem out of place, like an e-reader that looks like something quaint from the early 2000s, but it's an e-reader, so it's obviously from modern times. And you know, there's just lots of things that don't look in place. I mean, they go to ice cream parlors from like 50 years ago that are still up and running. Yeah. And again, I think that just, to me anyway, it adds about like, it just adds a sense of universality to the entire thing.
It doesn't set the time period, which I think is really cool. Like, you know, they're sitting there watching the old TVs, and there's a couple of, Mark, you were mentioning a lot of the furnishings and some of the lighting was really like 50s, etc.
I believe the term is anachronisms, Corey, yeah? Is that correct?
I believe it is. I didn't know which one of us was going to drop that. But what does that mean, Mark? What does that mean?
Well, that's a good question, Corey. It's not like we've just talked about this before this podcast, so that we can sound like we're intellectually smart and intelligent. Yes, it's to do with placing very old objects into a lot more modern settings. Is that right?
And that's cool. That is kind of cool. And I actually said to you, oh, there's no cell phones in this. But actually, the first scene opens up with the girl on the phone. She has a cell phone in her hand. You know, the first kill that we see at the very start of the movie. So yeah, mixes and matches everything here.
We've even got the old style cars, but I just genuinely believe they're in America all over the place. They just never left fashion.
Yeah, I didn't notice the cars. Even as I was reading we were reading some of the trivia as we watched the film there again, and I still thought the cars looked pretty new. But
the yellow one, come to think of it, was very vintage.
Oh, they're all brown and like square. It's like, oh.
And I think the one that really jumped out to me was when the Jay's sister's friend, who has the hots for Jay, when he's watching TV at night, looking out for her. And he's just watching off like a 1970s black and white stereo TV. And I was like, what? And then it was stacked on top of another one of these TVs. It was very, very in your face that he was watching something very old.
It was so strange. But yeah, bring a bit back to the cinematography. What were some of your favorite shots in the movie? I think me and Mark like literally gasped at one of them. It was a shot of it was through a car. To another, it was when she was running out of the house. It wasn't even one of the most terrifying shots, but I thought it was really beautiful. It was with the two characters, Greg, who kind of comes into it at this point, who was kind of like this kind of boy next door character. He's with a potential date, and then they're just kind of smoking in the car.
He just decides
to leave her, and Jay runs out of the house, and it's, you know, uses a lot of like zoom ins in the movie as well. I thought that was a gorgeous one. What type of shots can you remember from the film?
I think the jump scare. Well, not necessarily. Well, yeah, I guess they are jump scares. There was a few moments like I almost like they were good scares in the film, and not cheap ones either. I love the one where she knows that the monsters come into the house, and she's then screaming, and she's like kind of down on the ground up against her bedroom wall, and then she's trying to convince her sister and her friends that they're in the monsters in the house, and then I think one of the sister's friends comes to the doorway, and then all of a sudden the character comes out of the darkness, the monster, as like this 6'6".
Older man. 7'7". I found out the guy who played him is one of the...
Is it Carl Struycken?
Yeah, he's a twin. He's one of the few like 7 foot plus identical twins. So he has an identical twin, which I'm annoyed they didn't get his brother. I suppose there's only one beast, but it would have been good if that had his brother in it as well. That was terrifying, yeah.
Very terrifying. Like, you wouldn't want to go back to your house after that. And then the one at the beach, I thought, again, what the film did really well was to switch perspectives of, or were you seeing it through Jay's perspective where you can see the monster, or seeing it from their friends' perspectives where you can't see it and you can only see the actions being created from the monster. Like, for example, on the beach where the character's coming up to her, and then all of a sudden you see, you think you're going to get Jay's perspective, but it's actually the friend's, and you just see her hair lift up into the air. I thought that was really, really good.
I did wonder why it just lifted her hair, though. That was my one question. It's like the other girl who died before, she just got her leg absolutely thwacked open, and then Jay just gets a little tug.
Maybe you just want to have a good little sniff of the hair.
For the cinematography, I actually really like the scene, even though I've complained about the lighting already, but, I mean, they're going to light everything this way. It's fine. After she's had sex with Jake Weary's character for the first time, the guy who's passed on this monster to her, and she just leans out and plays with one of the flowers or one of the weeds growing out of the ground. I felt like it was such an innocent moment in a way. It does fit again with like that coming of age style where she's met this guy and has had casual sex in the back of his car, but instantly she's already looking at this weed that's growing out of the ground, and she's playing out like she's a kid with a flower. You know, it's just like, it's just this very nice little moment.
Whimsical.
Yeah, that just like sort of punctuates. Yeah, it punctuates like how dark the rest of the film, the scene in the film is going to be, because it just kind of shows that she feels safe around this guy. She feels safe to have these little moments of vulnerability and innocence whenever it's... I mean, if you go into the film knowing a little bit about it, you're just waiting for something bad to happen. So yeah, it's a good choice, I think.
I also think this sort of concept, it's such a good concept because there's so much you can do with it. It raises so many questions as to... who should, you know, what's the responsibility that she has in possession of this monster? Should she be passing this on to someone else? Who then eventually, one of them, eventually, spoilers, dies from it. You know, there's a lot of guilt that's associated and attached to that. And then even though that other character dies, she goes in ahead and passes it along again, has sex with her sister's friend. Even though she understands the consequences. Now, obviously, he wants to take that from her and defend her, I guess. But, I mean, again, there's just so much you can kind of explore with that sort of responsibility.
Yeah, I think you can... It's very interesting to think about that responsibility, whether or not you read it as something that's like... You know, if you read the monster as... I mean, the two biggest ones tend to be sexually transmitted disease or... sort of guilt of sexual assault. Well, not guilt, but trauma of sexual assault, and about passing that on to other people. I mean, this STD, I mean, you don't pass it on to other people, obviously. The trauma, I mean, she's essentially going at this alone. She's got her friends to help her, but the ones who can actually like help, she doesn't open up to fully in a way. She doesn't want them to feel the effects of it.
Yeah, moving on to the score of the film. It's done by a is it a artist or a band called Disaster Piece?
I believe it's an artist.
An artist, yeah. And this is what Alex has a list of artists that are artists that sound like they're bands, but they're actually just one person. Is this one of these examples?
Oh, this might be. I haven't listed them.
But yeah, the music is absolutely amazing. It's very John Carpenter-esque, synth heavy. It's also a great score that you can actually just put on and listen to through, because it's very I'm not going to say easy listening, because some of it is very intense, and it really adds to the scenes. You know, it is like a part of the film. What did you think of it, Mark?
Yeah, no, the music was good, and again, it adds to the whole 70s feel of the film. I like the synth music. It had its own identity.
Yeah, moving on to, we've kind of called this, they call it on IMDb a supernatural force. I think we've called it a monster and a demon and all sorts tonight. But it's interesting some of the ways that it's kind of displayed during the movie, because the guy at the start says that it can appear as someone you love or people you know. But as far as we know, we don't really see that until the last manifestation of it.
Yes, that's right. And even then, it doesn't show it until after the fact. I mean, the last iteration of the monster we see is Jay's father, and we only see Jay's father in a photograph.
It's very subtle. Yeah, subtle. Yeah,
very subtle. After it's gone, that's you see the last time you see the father, it's not the monster, it's just a photo.
And that's another really good shot, is seeing the father as the demon. Like, I didn't catch that it was her dad, but it was the idea of the car reversing, and then the camera again pans back, so that it exposes the roof to see the father stark naked on the roof. And on that note of every time the supernatural character comes up or shows up, nearly always they are partially or fully naked. What are your takes on what that represents?
Big take on that. namely, just I think it's a really slick way to differentiate between what is the monster and what isn't, because even though they don't understand what's following them, as long as anyone's walking towards them, it can be someone. It could either be someone innocent or it could be the monster coming for them. Just to demarcate that for the audience, every time you see the monster coming towards them, it's dressed for bed, which is why there's a lot of ones that are naked. Some are in their underwear, some are in nightgowns. A lot of them have like some kind of wetness to them, like they're either soiled themselves or they're just dripping for some reason, which obviously comes back in the end. But speaking of the end, there's a big sort of a shot at the very end that's done in nearly any horror film worth its salt, to try and say, is the monster still going to come back?
Yeah.
Is there going to be more of this? Have they finally escaped? And you see someone walking towards them in the background. And the first time I saw this, I was like, ah, yes, that's just what you have to do, isn't it? You have to be ambiguous. You have to do this. And then it was on the third watch, I'll admit, I noticed, I was like, he's wearing a hoodie and shoes. He's not going to bed. He's not the monster. That's fine.
Maybe the monster has evolved into a new form. The monster's evolved. It no longer wants to sleep. Yeah.
No, I refuse.
On second watch, actually one other thing I noticed about the monster, which, you know, maybe in a sequel, or I might talk about that in a wee bit, but in other movies they might have played on that a bit more, but when it attacks him in the beach, it changes itself depending on what it needs. So it's kind of like a woman walking towards her. And then as soon as they lock inside the beach house, or it's like a barn or whatever.
Boat house,
that's the word I need. It kind of transforms into the 7-foot one, so it's strong enough to kick a hole through the door. But then obviously the 7-foot guy can't fit through the hole, so it turns into this like little boy basically. And I thought that was really interesting, you know, that it was like switches to seeing what it needs. And I thought they would have used that a bit more.
What about like, I don't know if you, Alex, had the conversation about this after you left the cinema the first time you watched it, but we all had the discussion of how could you get rid of this presence. And my suggestion is you fly to a very remote island for a couple of hours and then fly home and fly back and make sure that it's so remote that no one else will ever fly to it.
So are you saying it's coming with you to the island?
I think it just reorients you wherever you are. It doesn't follow straight. My thought was like Red Light District, Melbourne. Just all your money, go for it. And then just...
Where are we going with this?
No, we're just... If you were in America, you wanted to go somewhere completely far away, have it just walk the whole way to the water, get rid of it, and then if you go somewhere where casual sex is going to be had a lot, it's going to just be passed on constantly through this whole string of people, and then it's done. Oh, yeah, so then... Because it always goes back to the person before, so yeah, that's my thought. If I really wanted to survive and had no money...
So your suggestion is... that you travel far away over water and it will then travel, walk to the water and then...
I'm assuming it'll just swim.
Swim to
I
you?
I assume it'll swim
and
to
then,
you.
And then where's the red light district?
Anywhere in a different country that's very far away.
Right, okay.
So like just through all your savings to get a flight to Melbourne.
Yeah.
And then just have a bit of fun and go away. And just
and
hope that
right.
because it's taking a really long time,
that it
there'll be enough change.
Person.
It'd be really bad if, I don't know, something happened and
yeah.
it just came straight back to you and you flew back home and it's just down there and you're like, what?
Aww.
What happened? But, I mean...
Well, yeah, that is another thing. So we touched on zombies earlier, that a lot of thing in the zombies movies is that the zombies are always coming for you and they don't really care what's in the way. So we've seen in zombie movies where they... walk into water, walk into fire, or like in, we were talking in the last podcast about the Dawn of the Dead one where it literally walks up boxes and gets his head cut off. But this thing is quite smart. That they thought it was this kind of thing, just walk straight towards them. But as soon as they get to the pool bit at the end of the movie, they think, right, it's going to get in the pool and then we'll electrocute it. It just stops, starts lifting the appliances and like turfing it at Jay's head.
Yeah, you're right. It didn't go into the water.
Yeah.
Well, my plan's done. Okay, where could you walk to from Brazil? Let's go to Brazil.
Yeah, because we were looking it up halfway through the movie. We kind of looked at, so if you were in, say, the west coast of America, you can drive to the east coast in 21 hours, but it takes 38 days to do the walk. So you've got like a month and a bit to play with in each location. Just keep going back and forth.
I wonder what the cost.
A lot of cost. A lot of part-time work.
Like just make sure you work somewhere else. So you're flying back and forth. You know, so your long distance work, basically. And
even,
it's covered.
Yeah, but if you go for... I can't believe this conversation. It's so dodgy whenever you go for it, but I mean, if you did like get someone who was very active, it would just pass around so much that within 38 days, you'd have such enough of a buffer, I feel like. Actually, hang on, if it doesn't go through water, just move to a different country go to an island.
And then you'd be fine.
Yeah.
But we're not sure. The Corey was like, maybe you could just keep swimming.
Maybe it can walk on a plane.
Charter a jet.
Finding Nemo and It Follows. Perfect pair.
Yeah, so what did you think of the kind of the grand finale of the movie? We talked how, you know, we said that it's quite slow, it's quite a slow burn, so the grand finale isn't like a big fight off, it's just this kind of really interesting scene at the pool. But did you like how the film wrapped up? Is there any way you would want to see it differently? Would you like to have seen them like kill it for good, or would you like to have seen them just, I know, I'm not sure.
I like the swimming pool idea. I mean, I didn't think it needed to be bombastic and large. I liked the swimming pool idea. I really did. And I liked, again, the perspective of seeing the supernatural thing through the Jay's friends. So you were trying to locate where it was and trying to shoot it. And as you can, like, one of the things that happens is Jay's sister's friend has a gun and tries to aim at it. Obviously, it's invisible to him, and then ends up missing. And it and the girl's behind him, and he shoots the girl in the leg. But then someone had the smart idea of putting a cloth over him, you know, to actually identify where exactly the supernatural thing was. Yes, I did think it was a little, as Alex was saying, a little cliche to kind of leave it very open-ended, like, is it dead, is it not? And it clearly wasn't dead, because... we've seen it before, being shot in the head. Had it been shot in the head?
It got shot in the head in the pool and then swam and grabbed her leg and then got shot again. So I'm assuming it just kept going.
Oh, yeah. I don't think bullets really stop it, or at least it maybe slows it down slightly. Mm. I think you could have, you know, I mean, we can get into this in a second, but there's so much, and I'm not saying this is good or bad, but there's a lot of franchise potential with this concept. And I'm surprised we haven't had another film with this concept since. But I think you could have done other things, like ways to break the curse of, like, Final Destination. One of the ways that they tried to break it in the second film was trying to allow someone was to give birth, and they said that the birth of new life would break the chain of death. And I was like, maybe you could introduce something, you know, not quite that, but something along those lines, where something like through the, you know, when through the sexual activity, then a child is conceived, and then that could maybe break it, or something along those lines. So maybe like some sort of interesting twist to try and break it.
No, I think you're spot on there. I'll start by saying I actually did not like the ending. First time I watched it, second time I watched it, hated it. Third time I watched it, I convinced myself it's okay. And here's me saying it, I actually really loved the film even with the poor ending. I just thought it's almost like it's just trying to revert back into that standard horror. How do we have this big final showdown with the thing, whereas the rest of the film is just so thematically handled. I mean, again, in my head, I'm reading this mostly as like this kind of, you know, the monster is like this allegory for STDs, for like notions of shame attached with casual sex and sexuality. So whenever the fact that they're constantly running from it, or even one of the big reads is the inevitability of death. And I mean, these are all things that they realize they can't run from. They keep trying, but they can't run from. And then to sort of go into the swimming pool and saying, right, we're going to trap it and shoot it and it's going to be all fine. I thought it was a little bit of a cop-out. And I thought, for something that's like been so quiet, so thematic, why does it have to end that way? And the only way I kind of enjoyed it in the third time was thinking, you know, this would make sense to me. If this is a group of kids that like have no sex education, they're in this weird, like timeless place where everything's old fashioned and they don't have like, you know, proper access to all this education. What would you do if you had an STD? You'd find some absolutely ridiculous home remedy that's informed by things you've found in life, things you've seen on TV, whatever. And you'd try that, and then you'd realize it doesn't work, and you'd go back and you'd go to the inevitable. You realize, right, okay, that didn't work. I have to either accept, you know, that death is coming and just do what I can to get through it. I have to give up my hang-ups about sex. I have to go to the proper sources, find the information, all this kind of stuff. And I think the other ending is stronger in the sense that Jay and Keir Gilchrist's character have sex and he passes it on, and they just accept the rules of the game and carry on with it. There's no quick fix. There's no, you know, deus ex machina or anything. It's just the logic's been set for them in that opening scene or that early scene, and they just have to run with it.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, we've touched on there, as you say, we've seen in a lot of horror films, there's always that scene at the end where you either see it in the background, like we see here, that the demon still exists, or, you know, they pop up at the end and kill the main character, which you see quite a lot in movies. But it often is done to set up a sequel, as we've talked about. So there's no kind of, I'm not sure the film's in production at the minute. I know there was talks of an It Follows sequel, but it'd be interesting, where do you think it's going if there was a sequel? Now, just watching the movie, I was thinking, this is a perfect film that it would have then one of the characters go off to like college where like sex is rampant, you know, in the first year, and then there could be a lot of like a really fun kind of college movie where it's passed around and there could be douchebags, characters getting killed off left, right and centre. But I think that would be a really fun way to kind of make it a bit more. But then the sequel, that could also be very like just a wee bit schlocky and kind of doesn't have the same feel that this one has. Yeah,
well, like this one, yeah, I think it could become very tacky and very cheesy and very cliche. You know, like most franchises, they always end up that way in one shape or form. I think the more I think about this, because honestly, it's such a money-making idea, because it's so low budget. It's a bit like Final Fantasy. All you need is people. There's no CGI that you need for this really at all, apart from maybe making someone invisible. So, you know, you could make these very low budget and they would make lots of money. So I think, I don't know who was producing it. I feel like there's probably some sort of copyright issue over using it again, or someone's decided, no, I don't want to sell this idea for more films. Otherwise, I think it would have been used.
I think this was actually 1.5 million budget and it
grossed like 20 million or
something. Yeah, like that revenue's mad. It only needs to make about probably twice that, so like 3 million to start making money, so it's probably made at least 17 million out of that. So, I don't know. I think there's probably been someone who's put their foot down, I reckon, with using the concept. But yeah, moving forward, yeah, I wouldn't want to just repeat it. There's loads of scenarios where you could include it and loads of like different locations. But I would have liked to seen maybe even two or three films all following the same characters, and then some sort of smart idea to try and break the chain of events, like going to a GP surgery. I don't know, something.
I don't think it needs one, but I would watch that if that's the ending. If that's Endgame, I would watch that happily. I feel like it's the kind of thing that as soon as something makes that much of an impact or that much money, especially in horror, you really, like, there's always going to be talk of like a sequel, whether it's with the original director finding some interesting idea or a studio just wanting to make more money, being honest. It never felt like any kind of film that really wanted or deserved a sequel, just in the sense that it's a complete thing. I mean, it does exist in this kind of like new brand of elevated horror where, again, it almost has like a higher importance of itself. You know, it's not just there to be like thrills and money. There's also like this extra layer to it if you want to take it or if you don't. And to me, like, those don't tend to have many, like, most of those don't tend to have sequels. The only one I could maybe think of is like Monsters having a sequel, but it was turned into a thriller and was supposedly terrible. I never went to see it. And I mean, as a film as well, it doesn't need to stay relevant in a way. It doesn't need more to stay relevant. It's sort of, it had its moment, it burst out, and you could even like, even whenever I was watching it again, a little part of it, I arrived early while they were finishing watching it, but one of my thoughts was just like, it's still almost relevant today in a sense of this kind of film about sex, casual sex, shame, in America, in this timeless space in America. And at the minute you've got the Supreme Court trying to police sex, and one of the members, Clarence Thomas, stating that he wanted to rescind laws that protected the sale of contraception to anyone. Like, that's the kind of world some Americans still live in. And the fact that 12 years later, a film that you'd say, okay, this has this view of sex, and, you know, you think 10 years on or so, it'll be a little bit more evolved, it'll be a little bit dated, it won't have any kind of potency. It still is potent in a way. It still tackles like that kind of passed on idea of, oh, sex is shameful, sex is this, there's all these bad things that'll happen to it. You're, you know, even just by having casual sex, you're somehow this victim, you know, that still exists. I think that's, yeah, I think it's still relevant and doesn't need more. And I'm kind of glad that it doesn't have any more, because it just stands alone.
No, definitely, because, I mean, you know, franchise is a big issue these days, where a lot of stuff just churns out sequel after sequel. And yeah, it's great that we got this film that's kind of, it's still so watchable now. And one other thing before we finish up, I thought I would bring back, and we've said we would do this more often, but the Letterboxd reviews of different people's thoughts on this movie. And I just want to share a couple with you. So the top one is, you know what? I still don't know what the fuck that seashell reader is, and it's really pissing me off. I think that's a great one. Next one is, I now present you with John Carpenter's The Spectacular Now, which is just, I don't know if anyone's seen The Spectacular Now.
I've never heard of The Spectacular Now.
It's an A24 like film. It's very much like this, but yeah, that's kind of funny. And what are the other ones there? I think I got one more for us before we finish off. Sex ? Cancelled. That's but the score for this movie and how it complements and amplifies every scene really is the cinematic equivalent of being repeatedly tasered in the nipple with a stun gun for 100 minutes solid.
Which Letterboxd user it's typed Lucy. That? Lucy.
Yeah.
Good old Lucy.
Famous Lucy.
Famous Lucy. Good go, girl.
Yeah, so I think that's us for today on It follows. David Robert Mitchell has another great film called Under the Silver Lake. I don't know. I think you've seen it, Alex.
I've seen it. Yeah.
I'm a fan of that film. It's pretty good. It's very different. Very different.
It's kind of like, if you want to say It Follows is like a really cool spin on, like, all these old horror films, and has little bits of Halloween or something thrown in. Under the Silver Lake is maybe more like A24's Mulholland Drive, which is both an insult and a compliment, and I'll not tell you how much of each it is.
True. I actually don't even know what David Robert Mitchell's up to next. He made It Follows in 2014 and Under the Silver Lake in 2018. So by that account, he should have a film out pretty soon.
Next month, secretly.
Yeah, so, well, thank you very much, everyone, for listening tonight. And Mark and Alex, thank you very much for the podcast. And we'll be back in a couple of weeks' time with another new episode. But until then, you can continue to follow us on all the social medias. Just look for Film Frequency. And until next week, I will keep watching films, and goodbye.